ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At a rural picnic spot in the dark, a young man suddenly disappears.
You could nearly say an alien took him away because he's just vanished.
When more clues from that night surface, something doesn't sit right.
It's nonsensical where the stuff is. It's been scattered.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
Is it a murder? Is it someone just gone missing?
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the dust settles on the government's big federal budget announcements, questions still remain about how and when changes will take place. But what do some of Australia's leading economists think of the proposed policies a fortnight on? And power prices are set to fall for most customers, with even bigger drops for some businesses. What's driving that relief? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Daniel Ziffer.
And I'm ABC Business and Economics reporter Gareth Hutchins.
Gareth, lovely to have you here. There's been a lot of airtime, a lot of AI slop, a lot of articles, a lot of chat, including on this very podcast about unpacking the details of the recent Australian federal budget. You've got a great piece which people can read on the ABC News website that's got analysis from some of Australia's top economists on the policies that were put forth both by the government and the coalition. So who did you talk to and what did they have to say?
Well, I talked to Chris Richardson, Saul Eslake, Ken Henry, former Treasury Secretary, Amy Oster, and Nikki Hutley. So these are five economists that are very well-known commentators on the budget, and they had some interesting things to say. I thought it was important to get their perspective after a fortnight of this debate, because the debate has been swamped by complaints about some of the tax changes, and these economists made the point that we seem to be missing the bigger picture here. What the budget is trying to do, it's recognising something that we've known about for 20 years, which is the ageing population and the pressures that we'll be putting on the budget in coming decades. As the working age pool of people in Australia shrinks compared to the number of ageing who are over 65 and retired. So it's trying to address what's coming, those very long-term trends, is trying to rearrange the tax system so that it becomes more equitable for younger workers. It's trying to fix housing for younger workers. It's trying to do a lot of things. And we've been caught up in the weeds a little bit over changes to negative gearing and the capital gains tax.
So we've been very focused on the now of this budget, but you're saying when you talk to these people with a longer view, they're really making the point about our settings, about how we tax assets, how we tax income, and how over time we're just going to have a smaller proportion of workers compared to the number of people who will be depending on the system to provide.
Yes, because as the way that the tax system works, unfortunately, the personal income tax burden is getting worse and worse for that shrinking pool of workers. Personal income tax is the only tax that's increasing in proportion to the growth in the economy. All the other taxes are shrinking, including the GST. So we have to rearrange these things. These are the arguments these economists are making.
Mm.
Now, if I can just go through them quickly.
Please.
So Chris Richardson, he spent decades at Deloitte Access Economics before he moved independently a couple of years ago. Before that, he was an economist at Treasury and at the International Monetary Fund. He said he was very happy to see some big changes. Finally, you know, Labor and the coalition are talking about big policy ideas. Our tax debate has been tied up on tiny details for far too long. Now, he said he was a fan of changing the 50% capital gains tax discount, but he would prefer to replace it with a minimum income averaging for businesses rather than the 30% minimum tax. He said he wouldn't have done negative gearing because if changes to capital gains tax discount is fixed for housing investment, the negative gearing goes away as an issue because the two interact.
So there's been a lot of talk about these two together. So he's actually saying that you didn't have to do negative gearing because it's actually the CGT discount that's been driving housing investment.
Yeah. Those two interact in the housing market. So he thinks just fix capital gains tax and negative gearing goes away as a problem.
Now, I've been fascinated to hear what Ken Henry had to say. He's a former Treasury Secretary. He wrote a substantial attempt at a rewrite, kind of framework of how tax in Australia could work. He took it to government and it has largely sat on the shelf since then. What does he think about these changes that are being proposed now?
He's very happy with them. Generally, overall, he's happy that a government has finally used some of its political capital and had some courage to try to push these things through. He said Australia's tax system should be capable of generating more tax revenue. When the economy's performing as it is today, it's become so fragile that it's just not.
What do you think he means by fragile?
Well, the point that income tax, the tax, the revenue that's being generated is only being generated, it's being generated more and more on personal income tax of workers. It's taxing wages and salaries. When it should be generating more things from resource rent tax, for instance. But for various reasons, which we all know about, whether it's political donations, lobbying, people working out how to use the tax system to their advantage, the tax revenue from our resource rents is not what it should be. That's a big thing that Ken has been pushing for years.
And so some of the fragility is that we are relying more and more on income tax, which over time, as the working population shrinks, will become a smaller and smaller thing that we can't rely on as the base of our tax.
That's right. And if the GST revenue is even falling in proportion to GDP growth, you know you've got a problem.
Amy Oster started a think tank this year, the Policy Institute of Australia, but it has been an advisor to the Commonwealth Treasury, Victorian Treasury, and a partner at one of the big consulting firms. What was her take as the dust has kind of settled here?
Hers was a good one to listen to because she reminded everybody that budgets are only the beginning. They're the beginning of a long run of legislation and implementation to follow. She said this is actually, whether you agree with it or not, this is how tax reform should be done, because you present the budget, you open it up for debate, the government consults with industry and it consults with people in the Senate and House of Reps to slowly get it through Parliament. And the government has signaled that it's willing to talk, it's consulting right now. So she was happy with the process. But she just said that her early read on the budget's changes to capital gains tax discount, if universally applied, was that they would impact Australians who own or directly invest in small and medium-sized businesses. So she thinks that's something that should be fixed. She's concerned a little bit about what's going on with trusts. But again, open-minded, this is good because the government has put their policy out there, said this is what we want to do. Now, everybody, let's talk about it. How can we get it to work for everybody?
That's a really interesting point. One of the things that I was looking for in the budget was around biofuels. The industry has been desperate for a mandate, essentially making it compulsory to have a certain percentage of biofuels. It was literally one line in the budget which said the government will consult with industry about a demand-side mechanism. And decoded, that means we will have one, but we are going to work out with industry and with all these other groups how to make it work. So there's a lot of policy in this budget, even though we've probably been extremely focused on just the negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. Just to wrap up with our economists, you spoke to Saul Eslake and Nikki Hutley. What did they think about what's been announced?
Saul Eslake, he's a former chief economist of ANZ and Bank of America Merrill Lynch. He spent some time at the Grattan Institute as well. He's been there, done that. He was a chief economist at ANZ when Peter Costello was treasurer and had some run-ins with Mr. Costello in those years. Now, he's supported the government's decision to reform the tax treatment of discretionary trusts. He says they'll have to think seriously about the impact it could have on startups. So they'll have to figure out a way to treat startups differently.
That's a very specific thing, and it has been one of the loud elements, and I thought probably one of the ones that has the most chance to change, basically because startups' value when they begin is zero. So the capital gain is potentially immense, and they are competing for a highly specific talent, generally in tech, where options and often the pathway of these companies is telling people, stick with us, we can't pay you very much, but we will one day get bought or we will float on the stock market and you'll be squabillionaires. So I can understand that there is some reticence in that community about the tax changes because it might really restrict their ability to gain capital and support in those early years where they need money but they're not making any.
That's right. And both Saul and Chris Richardson said that they would prefer to see some type of income averaging for this rather than the 30% minimum tax, because to deal with this issue of startups making no money early in their life, if you can average out their income over a couple of years and tax that average, then it would help to solve that issue.
Now, Saul has one particular hobby horse. It's one of mine as well. I'm sure he might have mentioned it to you, Gareth.
He did. Now, Saul is very big on the poor way in which we distribute the GST around the country to the states and territories.
I think he has one specific one in mind.
Saul hails from Tasmania and he spends a lot of his time looking northwest to Western Australia, thinking, why is the government shoveling $7 billion a year to this government that is generating very large, embarrassingly large surpluses? As he likes to point out, so large that the government has to hide them somewhere in their state budgets.
I know we're not meant to have favourites, but Nikki Hutley is probably my favourite economist. What was her take on this budget?
She said she was initially very positive on budget night and day or two after, but she's just come to have some hesitations about it since. She's a bit concerned that the surprise element of the proposed changes to the taxation of housing, so negative gearing, capital gains again, will damage some of the public's support for major tax reforms. So she's concerned about the way in which these changes were sprung on voters. Once you do that, it's going to be very, you need the public to support these things to get them through, right?
Well, and one of the other issues surely is that because the government swore black and blue that they wouldn't do this at the last election and then they've gone and done it, it does make it very difficult for parties to say, we promise we won't or will do this thing, and, you know, time rolls on, situations change.
Yeah, that's true. But you can't help but think of John Howard's famous core and non-core promises, right? He famously broke some promises after the 96 election when he was first elected, did some things that he swore black and blue that he wouldn't do. The way that he characterised what he had done is that he was delivering on his core promises and these were non-core promises that needed to be changed, blah, blah, blah. Now, John Howard then went on to be Prime Minister for 11 years and he is universally held up as one of Australia's greatest Prime Ministers by the media and by the public. And so he was forgiven for those things and it didn't seem to tarnish his reputation. So governments just have to do what they have to do. If they think that they're going to break a promise, then they're going to wear it. But they're going to also have to just hope that they can explain their way through it and get out the other side and have people think positively about them in a few years' time.
Gareth, I made a core promise at the top of this podcast that we will discuss power prices. With CPI data set to come out tomorrow, there's something very interesting happening with power prices. I haven't been able to say this for a while. They're set to fall for most customers, up to 10%, some even bigger drops for businesses. This is the kind of event that the RBA will be tracking along with the inflation data that comes out tomorrow as it weighs up what to do with rates as it keeps trying to fight persistently high inflation. Part of what is so fascinating about all of this. So this comes from our energy market operator. We're talking about they call it the national energy market, but essentially it's everyone except for WA. This is a fascinating element.
Yeah, why do you think prices are falling?
Well, there's a few factors. There's a huge surge in renewables. Now, we're aware of that massive penetration of solar panels, big uptake on the battery program where the government was massively subsidising home batteries. We're seeing more industrial scale batteries. You know, all of this stuff, I find it absolutely fascinating because we really are building the plane while we're flying. I grew up in an area that's next to where most of Victoria's power is generated through coal-fired power stations. These are aging machines. They are quite literally buying the parts for them on eBay or making the parts, through the ingenuity of the workers who are there. These are far beyond their lifespan in many cases. And the reason that we are transferring to renewable power is, first of all, it's cleaner. It's also cheaper to produce power, but we have to build out this new electricity grid and also the ways of generation at the same time as we're farewelling these coal-fired power plants that provide kind of a base level of power. As we get more amounts of battery capacity, we're seeing that big spike in the middle of the day when the sun is shining, being transferred to the early evening when the demand is high. So we're seeing prices fall because we are getting, finally, a taste of what we were always promised, which is an electricity grid that makes the most of renewables, pushes the excess into times when it is needed, when the wind isn't blowing, when the sun isn't shining, and when demand is high. So it really is an interesting time. And it doesn't mean that this will continue. It doesn't mean that next year it'll fall again and fall again and fall again. They're still building out this grid. But What I'm interested in, Gareth, and you know more about, is how do you think this fall in what is the default market offer, essentially like a kind of baseline deal, doesn't mean that everyone is on this offer. In fact, only about 1 in 10 households are, but it's a reference point for all other power prices. What do you think the RBA sees and what do you think the economy sees as energy prices fall?
Well, this is really important because energy is the base of so many of our other prices because business runs on it. It's very easy to conceptualize why a rise in petrol prices can push inflation through the economy, because you think of a truck having to fill up with diesel, drive hundreds of kilometers down the road with their goods to deliver them. The price of diesel doubles, then what's going to happen to the price of the freight? And then the price that the retailers will have to charge when they're selling the goods that they've just picked up off the back of the truck. It's the same with renewables, the powering of manufacturing plants, the charging of cars, all of those things. If you can get the price of those things to go down, then it will impact the prices through the rest of the economy. If the RBA is going to be watching these prices fall, it's going to impact inflation. And as we can see, when it comes to the power bills for small businesses, they're saying that we could see price falls by a little over 12% in South Australia. This is for small businesses. 14% in Southeast Queensland, and by as much as 20.9% in New South Wales. Your power bill has been cut by a fifth in New South Wales, and you're a small business, you're cheering.
And that's huge. Victoria's on a slightly different regulatory regime. They're looking at falls of about 5%. This is a really big shift. Now, we talk about fuel a lot because we see the price on a billboard as we drive past it. You know, it's one of those prices we actually know all the time. We have a sense of it because it's so visible. We don't do that with bread and milk. We certainly don't do it with power. It's much more opaque. When we're looking at this upcoming RBA decision, we've seen how interventions in the electricity market in previous years have pushed down inflation, or what was going to be upwards drive from that. Do you see it as being so, in the same way as fuel, so involved in every aspect of the economy that this puts downward pressure on inflation?
In the long run, yeah, in the long run. I mean, at the moment, you've got those two warring things. We've got the prices of petrol and fuel, diesel, much higher than they were at the beginning of the year. If we're seeing now renewable energy falling and falling, eventually something's going to snap and we'll swap over completely to renewables. We're not at that point yet. But an idea just did occur to me. We drive through our streets and the big price we always see is the price at petrol stations. I mean, I wonder if big wind farms or big solar farms should have a huge price outside. So every time we drive past them, we can see how low the price is per gigawatt hour that these things are producing for people. Just to remind everybody of what benefit they're contributing.
Well, that's the reason different governments are starting to offer free power in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
Because what people might not understand about our power system is that some of the reason that coal fire is on the way out is it produces a very consistent amount of power. It's very hard to make more or less. You've got to change a lot of settings. It's not quick. It's extremely slow. There's this massive spike in the middle of the day. We have too much, so much so that in the middle of the day, a lot of coal-fired power stations are paying when they send electricity into the grid. They're paying a penalty because there's so much juice around. What batteries are doing is moving that excess, smoothing out the picture so that we have a more stable grid and, as we're getting this time, at cheaper prices in most of Australia. To wrap up, something fascinating from this week has been the exit of Mexican food chain Guzman and Gomez from the US. You've got to admire an Australian chain taking on the US, such a massive market in fast food, the chutzpah of launching a Mexican chain. I admire it. Maybe it was never going to work. Investors are delighted that they've stopped, but it doesn't appear to have stemmed the bleeding of losses of money that they're spending over there, Gareth.
Yeah, it's like an American company coming here trying to sell kangaroo meat, isn't it?
Yeah.
You just think, okay, good on you for trying. So a class action lawsuit has been filed in the US District Court in the US state of Illinois, alleging that Guzman has failed to provide the legal minimum notice of 60 days advance written notice before firing its employees. Now, it only told its employees a week ago that this is what it was doing and that it would be basically closing the next day. And so a huge shock to these employees, especially, you know what this means. These are people who are working for $20 an hour US, so I guess $30 an hour Australian. This is their life has been built around this, and all of the restaurants are closing tomorrow.
It's really interesting to look at it. They had about 300 staff in 8 locations around Chicago. They tried really hard. In fact, the co-founder was there for the last 3 months trying to make it work. Is there a flip side in the fact that the American chain Taco Bell, which sells Mexican food, has had 3 goes at Australia, is currently in its 3rd iteration, and the best it's got out to at the moment is 20 stores, having already, in fact, it was going to be the 3rd and done, but someone rescued it right at the end. Is it just really hard to break a new market?
I think so. I mean, think of how there seems to be something proudly patriotic that Australians feel about the inability of Starbucks to really get a foothold in Australia. Because I think, are you kidding me? Our coffee.
Starbucks famously got out to about 120 stores in Australia, retreated to about 15, largely in airports or in extremely high tourist traffic areas like Sydney's Pitt Street and Circular Quay and that kind of thing. They have in recent years expanded out because they've worked out Australia. Now you'll find Starbucks in the outer suburbs largely as drive-through locations. So they've completely changed from what they tried to do in Australia, which is come in, teach us how to drink really expensive watery coffee, and then act really surprised when we kind of went, yeah, nah. So lessons for anyone looking to build a large brand in Australia might be harder than you think. We're pretty mean. Well, that's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow, and be sure to listen to our midweek episode of Fuelcast tomorrow morning. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send us a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. That's ABC Business Daily, all one word, @abc.net.au. Gareth, lovely to chat.
Thanks for having me.